when are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Good morning and welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Arliss Bunny.
I'm Will McLeod.
Today, Will is talking about the importance of strategy for the progressive movements in the U.S. and the U.K. I'm hopping on deindustrialization and why neoliberal economists have been successful for three decades in pushing developed nations toward so-called knowledge-based economies. For the interview today, we have Daily Coast front pager Armando, who will make it clear that the U.S. Supreme Court is purposefully choking off citizen access to federal courts. Will?
But first, here's just two snippets of news that we think are important. An article in the peer-reviewed journal Scientific Reports has completely destroyed the idea that hair follicle drug testing actually works. That article is titled, "Finding Cannabinoids in Hair Does Not Prove Cannabis Consumption." Employers and courts are using hair follicle analysis to test for drug use. The oils and resins from cannabis don't actually move through the body to the hair follicles. They move through the air. In tests with subjects who used very heavy doses of oral-only cannabis, they found very few cannabinoids. That would be cannabis products like brownies or candies, where it's eaten instead of smoked. With subjects who did not themselves use cannabis, but came into contact regularly with cannabis smokers, they found levels of cannabinoids in hair follicles, which courts and employers would consider a positive test for cannabis use. Hair follicle tests don't actually discover whether or not someone has used cannabis. They discover whether or not that person has come in contact with anyone who has smoked cannabis. So, hair follicle tests should probably stop, as they've now been shown not to work at all. People are losing their jobs and losing custody of their children due to these extremely faulty tests. Arliss?
Candidate Ben Carson made a really, really ridiculous mistake in an interview this week. He confused the concept of budget with the concept of the debt ceiling. So let me make sure that everybody out there knows the difference between these things, because apparently a huge percentage of the GOP does not know this, which of course is extremely dangerous. The budget is a document which is originally drawn up by the President of the United States, given to Congress. Congress then goes through it and makes all of their changes, passes or not, because in many years a budget is never passed, but it never returns to the president for signature. So when Ben Carson is saying that he would make Congress create a certain kind of budget and sign off on a certain kind of budget, he can't do that. It's not anything that ever comes back to him for a veto. So he has no leverage at that point in time. Appropriations are when Congress agrees to spend money. And that's why appropriations committees in Congress are so incredibly powerful, because that's where the dollars come from. That's where fiscal policy happens in the U.S. government. Debt. Debt is the amount of money that the U.S. holds in securities. In other words, securities, U.S. treasuries that have been sold to the private sector on behalf of the U.S. government. That amount is debt, and some of that debt is as old as the Civil War. In other words, families rolled those bonds over, or the person who owned the bonds originally died, did not will them to anybody, and the bonds have essentially gone dead themselves. They're just lying there. So there is a lot of outstanding debt that the U.S. holds that is debt that people want, nations or individuals want to have held, because it's a good investment. Now, deficit. Deficit is the difference between how much Congress spends in appropriations and how much the Congressional Budget Office believes that we will receive in taxes. But we, as progressives, know that taxes do not pay for anything. There is no such thing as we're going to increase or decrease taxes in order to pay for blah, 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 blah. So when we talk about a deficit, we're really talking about something that does not matter at all. And now, a debt ceiling, what's that? A debt ceiling came from legislation back in the 1930s when we had a gold standard. And there was literally a limitation on how much money the U.S. government had to spend. Congress wanted to keep a lid on that. They created something called a debt ceiling and said that the Congress could not spend beyond this point, could not have beyond this point any more treasuries to fund activities of the U.S. government. But that became a null set when we went in the 1970s to fiat currency. Fiat currency, of course, means that we are no longer limited by things like how much debt we can carry. So a debt ceiling is an imaginary, solely political piece of business that the U.S. Congress is supposed to conduct. And in fact, we could completely eliminate debt ceilings, eliminate that legislation entirely, and never know the difference.
And one of the reasons that this is so dangerous is because when someone like Ben Carson doesn't know the difference between the debt ceiling and actually spending money, he's telling a lot of Americans information that is itself incorrect. And that puts the full faith and credit of the United States in danger. We are the only country on this planet that has never defaulted on its debts. We have always paid them. It's in our Constitution that we will pay them. And so when people don't understand these things and then want to leave the country, that's incredibly dangerous because it puts our entire economic future at risk.
Will be back in just a moment to talk to you about progressive strategy.
Welcome back. Today I'd like to talk about progressive strategy moving forward. We've gotten ourselves in a couple of jams politically that are entirely of our own making. And generally, they have to do with refusing to see the world for what it is and refusing to see what's in front of us. I remember people being really, really mad at Barack Obama for not being left-wing enough when he was never the second coming of Eugene V. Debs. He was always a moderate center-left Democrat. I'm seeing similar deification of Bernie Sanders now, and we've actually seen similar deification of Jeremy Corbyn. Corbyn was someone that I was really excited about because I thought he was someone who could take the Labour Party in a new direction. I thought he was someone who would be able to bring more progressive ideas up, someone who would stand against nuclear weapons, and that hasn't happened. The Labour Party at its conference very recently supported further austerity and moved forward in support of nuclear weapons. Corbyn doesn't seem to be the leader that we thought he was going to be. And unfortunately, he doesn't seem to have a sense of political strategy. The British press have set a pretty excellent trap for him, and it's one that he's walking straight into. And that trap is Scotland. He's allowed people to say that the major test of his leadership, the first major test of his leadership, is going to be the Scottish election in 2016. Now, Scottish Labour Party has been in trouble since the 1990s. It's not had the best time since then. There have been multiple leaders of the Labour Party since then, and not one of them has fixed the Labour Party's troubles in Scotland. So he has been asked and is agreeing that it is his job to fix in about 6 months what has taken about 16 years to fall apart. Now, if there was a different leader of Scottish Labour than the current one, who is Kezia Dugdale, he might actually be able to pull this off. Scottish Labour has had leaders in the past who had a strong vision for the Scottish Labour Party. Unfortunately, those leaders were all given marching orders from London and were prevented from doing their jobs. That was the criticism that Joan Lamont gave when she left her position as Scottish Labour leader. That was also criticism that was laid upon them by the media when talking about previous Labour leaders, such as Wendy Alexander, who tried to fight the SNP and was forced by London to walk back her comments. Now, the Labour Party has a leader in London that's actually willing to listen to the Scottish Labour Party. But the leadership of the Scottish Labour Party are weather vanes. Kezia Dugdale is a weather vane. Without a strong wind blowing up from London, she has no idea which way to point. And that's been the major problem with the people who are left in Scottish Labour. They had leaders. They had people who were willing to lead, but those folks hadn't been allowed to lead. So those folks left politics and went to do other things. Wendy Alexander's now working on getting women into positions of leadership in business. The rest of the Scottish Labour Party who have lost, all those really strong voices and leaders, are off in the business world, the private sector, working internationally, working for charities, working for unions. They've taken their leadership skills places where they're actually allowed to lead something. Kezia Dugdale's brilliant idea for how to fight the Scottish nationalists was to advise Jeremy Corbyn not to ever say the word Scotland while visiting Scotland.
It's the British version of the S word, Will?
Yeah, basically. Don't say Scotland. That was the advice they gave him. And the result is, I don't understand how you think that might work. Not only is pretending someone's nation doesn't exist a tactic likely to make them angry at you and therefore more emotionally nationalist, but it also brings up a lot of really hurt feelings because Scotland was actually once called by the British state North Britain.
Oh, nice.
So this has tones of the era of British imperialism about it that make Corbyn look completely tone deaf. The idea was that Scotland and England and Wales didn't exist and Ireland didn't exist and there was just British Britons in Britain. And nobody else. And everybody was all British together. And we saw how that has worked in the 20th century as the British Empire has completely fallen apart and the United Kingdom continues to tear itself apart. So Corbyn has allowed them to lay this trap for him. Corbyn has allowed his Labour leaders in Scotland to lead him in a pretty ill-advised direction and hasn't paid any attention to political strategy at all. Now, when we come back to the U.S., I get really worried that we're setting up ourselves for similar disappointment in the future. I remember how Barack Obama used the really lefty supporters that he had, and he used a tactic called hippie punching, which is he attacked the leftists in the Democratic Party, us progressives, to make himself look more centrist and more reasonable back when he was trying to reason with the Republican Party, which, as we saw in 2010, would like him out of the White House as quickly as possible, some of whom have actually wanted him to be killed, if you pay attention to the things that are often said about him on Twitter, the extremely racist things that are often said about him on social media. People talked about sending this guy back to Kenya, even though he was born in Hawaii.
Well, Kenya, Hawaii, come on.
Yeah, I mean, these guys don't have a particularly good grasp of geography. Hungria being a place they think exists.
That's right.
So this being the case, I mean, he tried to reason with the Republicans, which didn't work. We need to ourselves look like the reasonable ones in the room. And I'm seeing the sort of ultra-Clinton supporters and ultra-Sanders supporters lining up for another round of flame wars, which is going to help paint progressives as unreasonable. And we need to see the world for what it is, and we also need to see Sanders for who he is. Sanders is a great guy. I love Bernie Sanders. I'm officially undecided as to who I'm going to vote for in the Democratic primary. Because I like both of these candidates so much. I mean, just to talk about the good things about Sanders, unlike Corbyn, who was a backbencher who didn't accomplish very much other than sort of leading voices of protest against the direction of the UK, Sanders has led voices of protest in the US and also gotten a hell of a lot done while he's been in Congress. And that's why there haven't been major Democratic figures freaking out constantly about a guy who was not a part of the Democratic Party trying to run for president and be the leader of the Democratic Party. the reason that you haven't seen much freak out over that is because he has worked so well with Democrats in the past that everyone looks at Sanders from the Democratic Party and sees someone we can actually work with and trust, because he's earned that trust. However, we've also got Clinton, who is a master of political strategy. Every time they've come at her with some made-up scandal, she has been completely untouched by it. The Republicans' hatred of Hillary Clinton has given her a coating of Teflon.
Yeah, they've just done it so much so long that it becomes white noise.
Yeah, the American people will not ever believe anything that Republicans have to say about Hillary Clinton ever again.
And the GOP, Kevin McCarthy's error in saying that the Benghazi committee was specifically designed to do damage to Hillary's poll numbers is completely based on a fallacy, because no matter what, once somebody starts to run, their numbers come down. Once somebody's running against them, their numbers come down. The Benghazi committee had nothing to do with that. And the biggest reason that the Benghazi committee had nothing to do with that is that right now what we're talking about are what Democrats support Hillary. And Democrats aren't paying any attention at all to the Benghazi committee, because we've known it was a farce from the beginning.
Yeah. And so this hasn't hurt Clinton's support at all, and neither did the stupid email scandal. Which, you know, to talk about that for a moment, she did what she was actually allowed to do according to the rules. She didn't actually break any rules. And she came out and apologized for not breaking any rules because the Republicans demanded it, and we've moved on. Nobody actually cares about the email scandal.
Yeah. And as long as the Republicans keep pushing this into the forefront and keep pushing this in the news, it just becomes more white noise. In other words, it just creates a greater tin ear on the part of the electorate. And I think in some ways right now it's a good thing that they're going after Hillary so hard, because it'll make it very hard for them to raise the level of that bar as the election gets nearer.
I'm going to tell you right now, if it looks like Hillary Clinton is sailing to victory, I'm probably going to vote for Bernie Sanders, because I want him to have the biggest voice possible at a convention. Because if Clinton wins, I want him to take her to the left.
Absolutely.
That's one of the things I want to see. I'm really glad Sanders is in this race, even if he doesn't win, because he's going to make sure that when we have an actual Democratic debate, those six debates that are coming up, he's going to make sure that we talk about real issues.
Well, and think about it this way. It's not just the debate. It would be, if Hillary is indeed the nominee, then Sanders will have gone into the convention no matter what. Sanders is going to go into this convention with a tremendous amount of power. And the reason, for me, the reason by the time things get to Indiana, which is a Super Tuesday state, the reason for me to vote for Sanders is that I also want him to go into the convention with as big a stick as possible to push Hillary as far left as we can possibly get her. But imagine this. Imagine a Secretary of Labor, Sanders. Secretary of, I don't know.
Defense.
In my imagination, how wonderful would it be? Secretary of Defense, Sanders. Now,
Attorney General.
Senate
Majority Leader.
Yeah, Attorney General Sanders. So I want Bernie to have a really, really big stick, even if he doesn't end up being the nominee. And I think that will happen. Same thing would happen if Hillary ends up being the nominee. If Sanders ends up being the nominee, Hillary will have a big stick going into the convention, no matter how you look at it. So these two people are going to work together. And I really do think that you can take what Hillary learned from her run against Obama and pay attention to how she's handling Sanders now, and understand that she does not want to get into that bitter war again. And you look at how Hillary and Bernie are speaking about each other, and it's respectful. I don't think we're going to see the same level of viciousness.
Yeah.
And I think that's good. I think that's good for the party. I think it's good for our future. I think it's good for the next president of the United States, who will be a Democrat.
Yes. And I think it's important that those of us who are progressives, who are talking on Twitter and Facebook and writing articles at Daily Kos and in our independent media here, we need to look at that and look at their tone and realize that there's a strategy to it. Because when we start flame wars in favor of candidates who don't really want to have a flame war with each other, we are ending up in a situation where we're only hurting ourselves. We have to think strategically. We have to think about how a democratic civil war weakens our party and recognize that there are real issues that need to be discussed and that those issues are too important to be discussed by angry people screaming at each other. They need to be discussed by progressives who are thinking clearly and having a real conversation about where this country ought to go.
Exactly. And next up on Hopping Mad, I'll be talking about deindustrialization and neoliberal economists right after this.
And we're back. So, Arliss, you hear a lot of these buzzwords like post-industrial age thrown around a lot by neoliberal economists. But what does that even mean?
Okay, so there are a lot of phrases. Things like, our economy has been fundamentally transformed. And people who are thinking that manufacturing is no longer important to our economy in developed nations and in essentially rich countries. I want to start today by saying that a big, big hat tip to Ha-Joon Chang's 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. It's a book I've been reading this week. It's absolutely tremendous. And he gets some things wrong, frankly, because he talks, again, like many economists, about pay-for language, as in we need to find a way to pay for X, when, of course, we don't, because fiat currency. But the basics of what he has to say are really accurate. And he sets up the book in a great way because he talks in every chapter about what they tell you, in other words, what neoliberal economists are telling you, and then what they don't tell you, the real world. So when they're talking about deindustrialization, we've all heard these buzz phrases, things like post-industrial age that you just brought up, Will. And they talk to us about manufacturing has gone into decline in all rich countries, that services to some degree, but especially high productivity, knowledge-based services are the future of our economy, and that this is natural and we shouldn't worry our pretty little heads about it. We should, in fact, be celebrating. And of course, by the way, that's essentially telling us to fiddle while Rome burns, depending upon your point of view. And hey, they want us to all think this is so great that developing economies should just leapfrog straight past all that dirty manufacturing and go right into a service-based economy, which is why they're pushing service offshoring to India so hard. Here's what they don't tell you. Many of us don't work directly in manufacturing. We work in offices or shops, but we work in industries or professions which are entirely dependent upon manufacturing. Everything from retail to fast food is reliant on manufacturing. Manufacturing has fallen as a percentage of gross domestic product, primarily due to the fact that items manufactured tend to get less expensive over time. In other words, companies get more efficient at manufacturing a given good over time. So their cost goes down, and their price on the market goes down. This is particularly true in markets where, as most markets are, there's competition. And competition is driving the price of those manufactured goods down. Meanwhile, services, which tend to be things that are more direct and hands-on, those are things that are in many ways less competitive, and they can't be offshored. In other words, you can't get your hair cut by somebody in Guinea-Bissau. You must have it done by somebody who lives relatively close to you. So a service-based economy has little ability to export or to increase productivity, except for things like banking services, engineering, design services, those kinds of things. But even those services are very much, certainly engineering and design services, are very much related to manufacturing. In other words, those services exist for the purpose of manufacturing of some kind of good. So we must absolutely continue to have a manufacturing economy. And by the way, if you didn't know, the U.S. still has the second largest manufacturing economy in the world. And less than 10 years ago, we were still building more than China and India combined. So it's not really that manufacturing is not important and essential to this economy. It's simply that we are actually employing fewer people in the manufacturing sector in this economy. And that's why we're feeling like it's a post-industrial age. But manufacturing is actually no less essential to the U.S. economy.
So that idea that we are in a post-industrial age, that's just simply false. We're still in an industrial age. We're just in a more efficient industrial age.
Right. And know that things like service economies, countries with large service economies, have essentially a negative impact on the balance of payment. In other words, the international sector, we are taking in more imports than we are exporting in services. And that's how you end up, by the way, with a trade deficit.
So, which we heard last week isn't actually a bad thing necessarily.
Not necessarily, and not if Congress conducts fiscal policy in a rational way. But for them to do that, they would be driving money into manufacturing.
And for them to do that, they'd also have to be rational, which that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Right, exactly. They're all too busy crying, apparently. But... Yeah. Moving on. It is absolutely true that 1 in 6 manufacturing jobs has either moved overseas or vanished since 2000. And that's why we feel this deindustrialization so acutely. It isn't imaginary that we're feeling deindustrialized. It's simply that manufacturing is happening in a very different way in the U.S. than it used to. We still produce, by the way, about 21% of the world's manufacturing output. China is producing about 17% of the world's manufacturing output, and they have 19% of the world's population. Deindustrialization is a weird thing because it's kind of an optical illusion in some ways. There are significant changes in recent years in what gets counted as industrial output, and this is a large enough factor in the way we talk about manufacturing that's actually been given a name. It's called the reclassification effect. In other words, there were things that used to be counted as manufacturing that are now counted as services. And that just has to do with the way, you know, Bureau of Public Statistics essentially is keeping that information. So in some ways, the numbers that we get aren't equivalent forward and backward in time. Also, many manufacturing companies used to provide services in-house, but they have either sold or outsourced those functions as a result of that whole stick-to-the-knitting wave that went through manufacturing in the 1980s and 90s. And these operations that used to be counted as part of manufacturing, in other words, these services that manufacturing companies used to have in-house, and that can be everything from catering to tech support. Those are now, because they exist outside that manufacturing company, those are counted as part of the service economy. So it also just has to do with not only reclassification, but a movement in where the services exist in the way it gets counted. So that's all essentially an optical illusion. It's statistical. It isn't really a change in manufacturing. However, it is honest to say that China has genuinely essentially caused, and I say that in, as David Waldman would say, in bunny ears quotes, some deindustrialization, but not as much as you think. Really, China has probably accounted for, in total, about 20% of the world's deindustrialization, and that didn't happen until the 1990s. It didn't really start having an effect until the 1990s, and deindustrialization in wealthy countries started in the 1970s. You started seeing those big layoffs and that kind of thing in the 70s, all through the 80s. So that can't, none of that can be attributed to China or Mexico or India. That really directly has to do with how manufacturing happens, how it functions in this country. If you look at things in terms of constant prices, so you're adjusting for inflation, you're adjusting for a variety of currencies, that kind of thing. If you look at things in current prices, the decline in manufacturing in rich nations is far less than we think. Manufacturing has increased in productivity dramatically in this time. It's more mechanized, more efficient and effective chemical processes, whatever So goods get cheaper, they employ fewer people. And the problem with services is that if services try to increase their productivity, they can do a couple of different things. They can either decrease the number of people involved. So imagine a string quartet with three people. Obviously, that affects quality. Or they can decrease the amount of time they give to it. So imagine a string quartet playing a 27-minute piece in 9 minutes. Those things don't work because there's a huge quality hit. And so services in some ways can be decreased, but in most ways, they have to hold the line at a certain point. And because of this, services tend to gain in cost in ways that manufacturing does not. So what we see is services rising as a percentage of the gross domestic product and manufacturing falling, but it really isn't a direct straight across the line equivalency when you look at it directly. So what does this mean to us? And this is, I'm going to take this directly out of Hao-Jun Chang's book. The nature of society has changed. Factory workers cooperate more closely with their colleagues during work and outside work, especially through trade union activities. In contrast, people working in shops and offices tend to work on more individual basis and are not very unionized. Shop assistants and some office workers interact directly with customers, whereas factory workers never see their customers. People in today's rich countries not only work differently, but are different from their parents and grandparents. In this way, today's rich countries have become post-industrial in a social sense. So it's not really an economic sense, folks. It's really, I mean, it is to a certain degree. But it is primarily a social sense in which we feel that we are deindustrialized and feel that it's either a good or bad thing. And how we feel, we can control and change that. We can address that. So here's the other thing that Hao-Jun Chang talks about in his book that I think is really brilliant. He talks about good economic policy does not require good economists. Thank the great bunny for that, because good economists haven't been who's been leading us for the last 30 years. Mr. Chang discusses, he talks about leadership and talks about a variety of historically strong, essentially economic miracles, but they have been led by informed, intelligent professionals who were not economists. And then he says, and I really love this, and he says, over the past three decades, economists played an important role in creating the conditions of the 2008 crisis and dozens of smaller financial crises that came before it and since the early 1980s, such as the 1982 Third World Debt Crisis, the 1995 Mexican Peso Crisis, the 1997 Asian Crisis, and the 1998 Russian Crisis. And they did so by providing theoretical justifications for financial deregulation and the unrestrained pursuit of short-term profits. More broadly, they advanced theories that justified the policies that have led to slower growth, higher inequality, heightened job insecurity, and more frequent financial crises that have dogged the world in the last three decades. On top of that, they pushed for policies that weakened the prospects for long-term development in developing countries. In the rich countries, these economists encouraged people to overestimate the power of new technologies, made people's lives more unstable, made them ignore the loss of national control over the economy, and rendered them complacent about deindustrialization. Moreover, they supplied arguments that insist that all those economic outcomes that many people find objectionable in this world, such as rising inequality, sky-high executive salaries, or extreme poverty in poor countries, are really inevitable, given selfish and rational human nature and the need to reward people according to their productive contributions. In other words, economics has been worse than irrelevant. Economics, as it has been practiced in the last three decades, has been positively harmful for most people. Then he goes on to say, I stick to economics because I believe it does not have to be useless or harmful. It is a particular type of economics, that is free market economics. As it has been practiced in the last few decades, that is dangerous. And that, of course, takes us back to Joe Firestone's interview last week. If you haven't heard that, go to iamhoppingmad.com and listen to Joe Firestone be brilliant on the subject of trade and free trade. And next up on Hopping Mad, we have the fabulous and always interesting Armando from Daily Coast talking about citizen access to federal courts. We're back on Hopping Mad. Lawyer and Daily Coast front pager, who is also a frequent contributor to Daily Coast Radio with David Waldman on KGRO in the Morning, Armando has joined us to talk about how citizen access to the Supreme Court is being choked off. Armando, you deal with a lot of antitrust cases in your practice, so this issue has a direct bearing on you on a daily basis. Can you put us in the frame by giving us basically the 30-second definition of what is antitrust, and then also a little bit of history on the Sherman Act, because most of us aren't lawyers?
Yes, and thank you for having me. When we think of antitrust law, most of us really refer to the law, the Sherman Antitrust Act, which was passed in the 1880s. The name sponsor of it is Sherman, not the great general, but actually his brother, who was a senator from Ohio. It is a law that has very plain language that's very simple and really requires, in its essence, a lot of judicial involvement. It basically, the essence of it is that it prohibits unreasonable restraints of trade. Now, what does that mean? Well, the Supreme Court has spent 120 years telling us what that means. And, of course, in one of the most famous and important cases that really established what it could mean, was the Standard Oil cases, where the government broke up Standard Oil into the seven petroleum companies that were most familiar to us all, Exxon, Esso, Standard, et cetera, that we are, of course, familiar with now. And some of them don't all exist, and some of them have reformed. But that's when the first understanding of what an unreasonable restraint of trade might be and how you might judge it. And that case famously created what's called the rule of reason. That is, well, in essence, the judge gets to decide using reasonableness as a standard as to what an unreasonable restraint of trade is. Different standards have held forward after that, including what's called a per se rule. That is, that certain actions were deemed to be per se violations. That is, there's no wiggle room for a judge. If you can prove that something occurred, then that's a antitrust violation. That's the essence of Sherman Antitrust Act, and it's really one of the important laws. Of course, there's other aspects on price discrimination, something called the Robinson-Patman Act, which is frankly rather contradictory and bizarre in many of its applications, and really it's hit or miss. It has impacts on a lot of businesses, basically just from custom of what people think they can and can't do. There isn't that much litigation under that, and on occasion the government does apply it, but it's not, I don't think, the bulwark of what we think of as antitrust laws. One of the most important innovations in antitrust law was the government's review of mergers and acquisitions under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act in the 1970s, the Watergate era. And that law requires that certain types of mergers and acquisitions, which create a certain concentration of market power, are both problematic and usually not approved by the government, but subject to review by the government anyway. And in essence, you'll see these big deals, the famous deal I think that was struck down recently, the cable deal that the government panned, and I believe there was an AT&T merger with T-Mobile that the government recently didn't approve. That comes because of the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act.
And so that's Comcast Verizon? Was that the one that got struck
down?
Yeah,
Comcast Verizon was one of them. You're right. And it's not uncommon. It happens every day. They've even invented this thing called the HHI, which is how you determine market concentration for the relevant markets. And that's, in essence, what people mostly fight about when they talk about Hart-Scott-Rodino. How you determine relevant market for HHI purposes. Now, I don't want to get in the weeds because that really isn't what you had me on for, but I did want to give you the three basic bulwarks of antitrust law under the United States jurisprudence. and what the Supreme Court has done to it. Now, in terms of Iqbal, and Iqbal follows a case called Bell Atlantic Corp. versus Twombly, which was decided in 2007. And the interesting thing, and why it's had wider repercussions than most antitrust decisions do, is that an antitrust complaint was dismissed not at summary judgment or on some theory of what you need to prove. And we have time, I can tell you how that has been perverted by the Supreme Court on what the standards of proof are for an antitrust plaintiff.
Yeah, I did actually want to go there because I wanted to talk a little bit about Connolly and then how that has been, how the Roberts Court has, quote, retired Connolly.
Yeah, well, Connolly, of course, Connolly v. Gibson. It was a 1957 case that basically set forth what is what's called the Rule 8 pleading standard. Now, what is Rule 8? Rule 8 is the rule that determines what you need to say in your complaint. That is, it doesn't go to the substance. It's just what are the pleading standards? What are we looking for? And if you read the rule textually, it requires the following: a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. And it says specifically, detailed factual allegations are not required. For lawyers, that's what we call notice pleading. And what it is, it's putting the defendant on notice of what it is you are claiming is the violation. So in general, you could have said something that basically tracked the statute. You, in an antitrust context, you did A, B, and C, and that's an unreasonable restraint of trade, and therefore you violated Section 1 of the Sherman Act. Or if it's a conspiracy claim, you violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act. And this was understood to be as broad and as liberal for pleading as you could imagine. And that's why, in essence, pleading has never been the big part of federal cases of any kind. That's not where you win or lose your case. And the reason why behind that, the policy rationale is, we don't want to get bogged down in technicalities of what you put on a piece of paper. We want to know what you can prove. So just tell us what it is your claim is, and then we'll, the court, figure out if you have the evidence to prove it. And that's so, really been the standard until Twombly.
Yeah. So Connolly, the standard was essentially what is conceivable. And
what is conceivable.
Yeah. Yes. And my understanding is that Iqbal Twombly, which apparently lawyers occasionally call Twickball, Twickball basically moved the standard to plausible. So from conceivable to plausible, these are really different things.
Well, it is, and it isn't in a way. Because if you take Twombly literally, it changes it, and it's a bad decision. I don't want to whitewash Twombly. And let me tell you, it was written by my favorite justice of that era, Justice David Souter. And I don't think he understood what he was unleashing. He wanted to say that you can't just say that I've been damaged because the sky is red. That was the idea of it, to be honest with you. Because under Connolly and under the standard, you were supposed to accept allegations as true. And at the pleading stage. Later on, of course, the pleadings are tested and evidence has to be produced. But at pleading, the idea in Souter's mind was you can't plead the sky is blue, therefore you caused me injury. I don't know if that analogy is working for you, but the idea of it is I get to look and not just accept your allegations as true. I get to see if what you're alleging is actually plausible. Like, what if you alleged that climate change is a hoax? Is that plausible? Scientists would say it isn't. And under Twombly, you could reject that to put it in a more positive idea. If you had limited it to that, you could have lived with Twombly. But what happened was the courts, including the lower courts, who remember, you've got to connect this to the way the Republicans block the appointment of judges. There are district courts all over the country that don't have enough judges. These are the same shortchange judges with impossibly ridiculous levels of federal criminal laws that basically pack the federal docket with 95% of the cases have to be criminal cases. And of course, you have the speedy trial issue under the Constitution in the criminal cases. So if you're a civil litigant in federal court, you're getting killed. So what happens? The judges, in order to clear their dockets, will often take any excuse they can think of to get rid of a case. Twombly created that in the sense that they started dismissing claims as not plausible. And, of course, it has closed the door to the courthouse to a lot of litigants for a number of reasons. One, it's just getting cases thrown out that shouldn't be thrown out. Two, it makes lawyers, and to be, you know, give you a full disclosure, I am not the kind of lawyer that does this, but they're an important part of our profession. That is the lawyer who takes cases on contingency. That represents the small guy, that brings the case, that has to be a class action, that has to have a lawyer willing to foot the bill so that, you know, in a year or two later, their client can get justice. And remember, there's another aspect to why we want justice. We, and this is from the law and economics theory, we want malfeasors to be punished economically, so they'll be a deterrent to them doing this. Think of this VW case on the diesel, which I'm sure there's going to be a million class actions. And people say, oh, look at those ambulance-chasing lawyers. But you know what the idea is? So that the next car company thinks twice before they do the same thing, before they cut that same corner.
So one of the things
that there's that aspect of it that's just taken away. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I think a question's coming in.
Yeah. So one of the things that's what seems to have happened is now that it's not a standard where the claims are considered to be true until it's time for court cases to happen, is now you have people who are being forced to provide evidence before the normal discovery stage goes forward.
And that's the fallacy of the plausibility standard is.
Yeah.
How can I prove plausibility before I've taken discovery? How can I do that? How can I bring particularized evidence of the plausibility of my theory when I haven't had a chance to take discovery? This violates our common notions of due process, at least as we lawyers have understood it throughout our careers. We never thought we had to prove our case in our complaint. And in theory, we still don't. But whenever a judge wants to get rid of your case, they'll go Twombly and they'll go Iqbal. Iqbal's even worse. When we get to Iqbal, I can tell you what became even worse. For now, we're talking about Twombly. And now to use this cudgel to basically close the courthouse doors to plaintiffs who have claims that used to be viable and now aren't. This is a denial of due process. It's really that simple.
And let's go on and actually talk about Iqbal now, though.
Wait just one second.
Okay.
I have one more Twombly question. One of the people I talked to about this was my patent lawyer, and he went absolutely off the cliff on the subject of Twombly, because Twombly specifically pushed outside of antitrust law and opened the door to the Twombly decision applying to all kinds of other law, like patent law. And it screwed them up tremendously, because it comes in conflict with other recent decisions.
And that's absolutely true. We handle a lot of patent work in my offices. I'm not a patent lawyer, but I do get involved in litigations involving patents. And the pleading, the stringent pleading standards have really spilled over very heavily in patent law. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that it's happened, because if you might have heard about the American Invents Act a few years ago, which many patent practitioners were strongly against. It really is a sop to Apple and Microsoft, and gives the small inventor really a tremendous hurdle to try to protect their ideas. It was another exercise in basically corporations getting their way.
Yeah, well, the Roberts Court is bent for business. I mean, that's their
This was an initiative of President Obama, the American Vent Act. So,
nice. It was legislation.
It's not just the Roberts Court. Sometimes it's our own team that takes steps that are pretty bad.
Great. Now, Twombly, my last question about Twombly is that it seems like it's introduced the idea that money trumps right. In other words, the cost of pursuing a complaint has to now be weighed against the time and money parties will expend in the process before it can even be argued.
Yeah.
You know, what the kale?
The rationale is all these poor corporations having to spend money to defend their actions. That was the thought process, and it's endemic in the entire antitrust procedural decisions that we may get to later. The Supreme Court has been so concerned that the poor corporations may have to spend some money on lawyers to defend their actions that they basically say, you know, the thing we got to do, we got to close the door to plaintiffs who have been harmed by these corporations in under antitrust law. It's really outrageous.
Judicial activism
of the worst sort.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, tell me in what ways Iqbal is even worse than Twombly.
Well, Iqbal, let's start with one factoid. Justice Souter wrote the Twombly decision, and he's in dissent in the Iqbal case. So you can imagine. What did it do? It turned plausibility into particularized proof. It took the step that Souter did not intend. Souter intended to just look at pleadings and say, is what you are pleading plausible? That's why I went to the sky is yellow or whatever, the sky is orange, whatever color the sky is, you know, it's an example. That's what Souter wanted to happen. Little did he know, and he should have, that the Roberts Five were going to turn his attempt to what he thought was a common sense reform of Connolly. The reality is the court shouldn't be in the business of that, but that's another story. And they turned it into a pleading standard that requires that you not only allege with particularity, that you also have the evidence to prove your particularized allegations in there, and they put that all under the rubric of plausibility. Now, what was Iqbal about? You know what Iqbal was about. It was about a lawsuit against the Justice Department. The name defended is Ashcroft, John Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General when the case started, and it's about allegations of racial and religious discrimination with regard to the actions after 9/11. And they basically sued the FBI, the Department of Justice, and basically accused them of discrimination. And the courts in that case said, well, you haven't alleged how John Ashcroft has anything to do with this. Or you haven't alleged it plausibly how he's doing it. Yeah, you alleged that he did it, but you didn't show me how he did it. You didn't show that he was supervising this guy, and you didn't show me the evidence of how this guy did that. In essence, what we would normally require in a summary judgment motion, in a case like this, was required at the pleading stage.
This sort of new regime has changed a lot of our civil procedure rules and change the way that the court looks at cases. And so I think the last question we need to ask before the broadcast ends is, can we legislate against this? Can Congress do something? What do we do about this problem?
Absolutely. Congress can overwrite each and every one of these decisions. Each and every one of these. And they've tried. There have been proposals. The Twombly-Iqbal issue has been, there's a bill every year on it. And, of course, with Republicans in control, nothing happens. Now, you would ask yourself, well, what happened between 2007 and 2010? At least 2009 and 2010. Well, I will say in the president's defense, he was dealing with some pretty big economic issues, so I wouldn't expect that this lawyer's concern because to the most people, this is just a lawyer's concern, wasn't on the front burner. And obviously, when Republicans are in control, that this isn't changing.
Yeah, well, there, and therein lies the reason that progressives need to vote. Just another good reason to get out to the
polls. Always comes back to that. But to answer the basic question, yes, absolutely. Congress writes and approves the rules of civil procedure. These are federal laws. These are not rules that are written by the courts themselves. These are congressionally passed laws.
So, folks, thanks for
obvious thing.
Sorry. So, folks, thanks for joining us today.
I didn't realize I talked that much. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thanks for joining us today on Hopping Mad. Stay tuned for David Waldman and KGRO in the morning. And if you'd like to check back with our website, iamhoppingmad.com, you can hear a little extra mad because we're going to continue our interview with Armando. And there'll be a lot more because there's a lot more to say on this subject. Thanks for joining us today on Hopping Mad.
And we're back with Extra Mad. We're here with Armando talking about the way that the Supreme Court's judicial action and judicial activism has changed the way that Americans can access the Supreme Court and access federal courts. Now, we've talked about Iqbal and Twombly and the way that they've gutted antitrust and the way that they're now trying to force people to prove their cases before we even get to the discovery stage. But they've also taken some actions which have really negatively affected class action lawsuits. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, actually, there are two cases of recent vintage. This has been a feature of the court, and it started when Rehnquist was Supreme Court Chief Justice, and Scalia has been one of the spearheads in these fights, to limit the ability to have class actions, and what they have done is built a body of law that's always made it much more difficult for a class to be certified. And why is that important? Because for a case to have a class effect, the court has to agree that the named plaintiffs are representative of a class of people. And there's Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure cover that. Now, the case that hurt most recently, of course, was the Walmart v. Dukes case. And I want to make a full disclosure here. I have represented Walmart in the past. I don't know that that's a shock to most people, because that was pretty well known about me when people were coming after me in 2006. But I just wanted people to know this. But I was not involved in the Dukes case. I did not, and I have not represented Walmart on these types of things at all. So I can speak to Dukes in this sense. The Dukes case basically overturned a Ninth Circuit decision certifying a class in a case where gender discrimination was charged against Walmart.
And this is 1.3 million women were part of this case, weren't they? I mean, it was
right.
A huge class action.
It was a huge class action. It was obviously a significant case. Whether the decision properly applied existing class certification law, I don't know. In the sense that I did not, as I said, I was not the lawyer in the case, and I can't speak here to you to whether the case was defensible. I will tell you this. The Supreme Court took the case in order to attack the concept of class actions. And it was a 5-4 decision, and it broke along the same lines as it always does. And they basically just raise the bar yet again for certification of class actions. And what we were talking about in the original segment is really apropos here. This is just another arm of how the Supreme Court has tried to make it more difficult for plaintiffs, the small mom-and-pop plaintiff, the everyday American, to coin a phrase, to have their day in court. Because these are cases where the economics of the case requires class actions. Because if you think about it this way, and when we talk about the AT&T Mobility versus Constant Joke case, it really will come into focus. Lawyers have to make enough money to live. And you can't charge what a case would cost when it's just a small, everyday American who doesn't have enough money to fund what these cases will take. Walmart will charge a battery of lawyers, sometimes that would be me, to go and basically run a plaintiff's lawyer ragged with discovery, with motion practice, you know, making the case cost for the attorney tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. What ordinary American can afford to take that case for it?
You know,
that is why you need mechanisms like a class action, or in some cases, in the case of Section 1983 cases or Title VII cases, award of attorney's fees. Why? Because at that point, the lawyer can take that case because he can make enough money that it becomes economically feasible. And again, let me step back and tell you that my comments are not self-serving. I don't do those kind of cases. Mm-hmm. If anything, I might defend those cases. Against those cases. But I can understand what the purpose of the law is, the purpose of class action, and the purpose of granting awards of attorney's fees in gender discrimination or race discrimination in Section 1983 cases. The idea is to give the ordinary American a fair day in court so he can have a good lawyer and have his case heard.
And this particularly affects things like housing, you know, fairness in housing, consumer safety, worker protection, worker
everything.
Equality, all of those kinds of things.
It affects everything, Arles. It is how people get their day in court. We can't all rely on the ACLU.
Yeah.
We can't all rely on the Department of Justice. The idea is we'll be private attorneys general. I don't know if you've heard that concept before. the idea was, is we're going to police these activities through the marketplace, believe it or not. Very Republican idea, right? Through the marketplace, by giving the market a chance, because that distortion of the justice market, because of the cost of going to court, was completely skewed. We could not police the activity of corporations without it. And we and you'll see that it's not happening. Yes, it would be great if the DOJ could do it all, but it can't.
And it's so, my understanding, I'm sorry, Will, it's my understanding with Concepcion that the damage to each individual member of the class was like less than $31, but there were millions of them.
Yeah, well, that's Justice Breyer in his dissent basically says, you're expecting a lawyer to take a $30 case. Lawyers don't take $30 cases. We don't. We can't. We can't do it. There's just no way to do it. So what is it? Now, the funny thing about this is, they relied on, in Concepcion, which is a 2011 case, it was ATT who brought it this time. And you know that their boilerplate, fine print, 300 pages of nonsense that you get in the mail? Yeah, one of those little provisions section that says there's going to be arbitration, right?
Right.
Okay, and those are what we call adhesion contracts. Now, what is an adhesion contract, just to give you a concept of it, is you don't really have any choices about it. It's not like you negotiated. You can't really negotiate with them, can you? I mean, if I don't like their terms, what do? Cross out the parts I don't like? They won't let me do that. So it's forced on you as a consumer. So there's nothing you can do about it. So they put that in there. Now, but the irony, of course, is that the Federal Arbitration Act, which is a law from 1925, is intended to encourage arbitration because arbitration is cost-effective, yada, yada. All right? And maybe that's what they thought in 1925. But what is arbitration now? It's to keep people out of court because no one wants to go in front of a jury. That's part one. Part two now is, you know, the arbitration business is kind of interesting, and a lot of arbitrators, unfortunately, and you know, the way the arbitration system works, who's going to be picking arbitrators most of the time? It's not going to be the plaintiff. They don't have arbitrations every day. It's going to be the corporation. So right there, you're going to build in a built-in bias for the arbitrator to favor the corporation, because that way they might get picked for another one. So you get that whole picture. But the Arbitration Act actually was intended to encourage arbitrations. So if you think of the Federal Arbitration Act in that sense, wouldn't it make sense that to encourage arbitrations, you would allow class action arbitrations, right? The general policy is to do everything to encourage people to use arbitration as opposed to the court to resolve their disputes.
So the judicial...
The
judicial activism of the Supreme Court has made it so that arbitration is now a built-in system. We have class action lawsuits being reduced in scope so that they're expecting people to take a $31 case. We have people being forced to try to prove their cases before discovery has even gone through. And even if we sweep all this back, we will still have a problem in this country where the corporations are over-lawyered and the people are under-lawyered. We already have that just at base level, and this court is actually trying to spew that even further in the directions of these corporations?
That's exactly right. People don't understand how important the Supreme Court is sometimes.
Yeah.
Because you don't hear about this case. We hear about it, but no, you know, the average American doesn't know that this case came down. They don't know what it means. And it's just amazing what the Supreme Court has done in a judicially activist way. They're not deferring to Congress.
Yeah.
They're not deferring to anybody. They do what they want, and it's outrageous.
So we have in criminal law, we have public prosecutors and we have public defenders. Do you think it might be time for us to set up an office of public litigation?
Yes. Yes, if we're not going to be able to use the private attorneys general model, we need that. That's the only thing that can impact it. Now, I would think, though, unfortunately, that if we had enough votes to create that, we could probably undo what the Supreme Court has done as well. I actually do believe that the system of private attorney general is the most effective way to get to this. You know, look, I mean, I'm a liberal and a Democrat, maybe not a liberal, maybe I'm a centrist, but the reality is that I do think that there are certain market forces that are helpful. And one of these has been incorporated in these concepts that have been so effective in the federal law. You remember the case, the movie, Erin Brockovich?
Now, sure.
You know, and she won the... Now, Erin Brockovich did great things, but a lawyer had to stand up in court and make the money and find all these terrible things that I think the company was PG&E had done. And let me tell you, after that decision came down, I bet you PG&E straightened up this act, and I bet you everybody else in the area behaved better. It is an effective way of policing behavior where the government can't be involved and see and stop everything. It just can't. But lawyers can, because there's a lot of us.
Now, my other question would be, in terms of protecting workers, different than Gen Xers and Boomers, Millennials seem to be talking in a much more positive way about unions, because unions used to be part of the balance of this. They would negotiate into union agreements certain protections and rights. And
absolutely.
Since the fall of unions, you know, the decimation of the union structure, workers have suffered broadly across the country. So I'm encouraged by the rise of positive action in terms of unions with millennials. I do think that is going to make a difference in the out years. It doesn't change things today or tomorrow, but it may very well be very different 10 years from now.
Yeah, I think this is an important development, and I'm with you on everything you just said. And I want to take a moment to praise the Obama administration on one point that isn't necessarily pro-union, but it is pro-worker. I don't know if you recall the big fight about recess appointments on the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, and how that all got worked out. At any rate, we've got a much more progressive NLRB than we had in a long time. And one of the most important rule changes that you won't hear about, but I'm living it now. And again, full disclosure, I'm not often on the labor side on these things. And I was at the NLRB a couple weeks ago on a wage claim that was brought against one of my clients. I tweeted this out, but I want to take a moment to tell you the story because I think it's great. As you know, I'm Latino. My client was an African American woman who owned her business. And the NLRB attorney was an Asian American woman, and I just felt like, you know, this is America now. It's in a good way. Anyway, leaving that aside, what the reason the NLRB this wasn't a union case. This was just an employee case, a workers case. The reason why that case is now before the NLRB is because the NLRB decided, rightly in my view, even though it's not favorable to my client, that they can step into labor issues that don't necessarily have to deal with collective bargaining. And that happened because we elected Barack Obama president in 2008. And it's an important protection that now exists for workers everywhere, union or non-unionized. That's just a small sliver of what a union can do, though. Unions, when you're involved with a union, you have a collective bargaining agreement. Disputes of all kinds are almost always handled in ways that are very, very fair to the worker. You know, the way the process is goes forward, what the proof levels are, et cetera, et cetera. Now,
and
you know,
frankly,
you run a business,
having
that
been
ties
in
you up a little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, having been in management at corporations that were unionized, frankly, they were handled in ways that were reasonable for the employer too. I didn't feel like the way those things got resolved with, you know, there'd be an individual issue with a worker, and it seemed like the union sat down, they had a rational conversation with management, and it worked out. And
it often did. And the reality is, even if you don't think it's completely fair, as opposed, because everyone thinks
that God is on their side.
What they want is the best for everybody, and that's not always the case. The point is, it's fair. It's a fair process, And just because you just don't get to do whatever you want without any repercussions doesn't mean it's not fair. You know, that's the reality. And in my case that's going forward, I'm certainly going to defend my client vigorously and see what I can do to resolve it most favorably to my client. But that's part of the process. And they have their lawyers. And, of course, the NLRB is the adjudicant, at least in the first instance. And that's fair. That's the way it should be.
Yeah. So we have overtaxed judicial dockets all over the country. And obviously the biggest element to solving that problem is to appoint judges. But is there anything beyond that? In other words, the Supreme Court essentially is promoting Twickball as a solution for the problem with judicial calendars. Is there something else?
Yes. Reform of our criminal justice system.
Oh, well.
Two aspects to the overtaxing of the federal courts. The one is the one you just mentioned, which is that there are too many vacancies. And the other is the criminal legal rubric that we have created is just overtaxing our justice system. When 90% of what a federal judge does is criminal cases, how can you get fair and adequate process on civil matters? It's simply unworkable. And we're not doing justice in civil cases in the United States in federal court anymore.
Yeah.
We're simply not. I can show you a million cases. Some I've been involved with that were favorable to me, some that were unfavorable to me, where justice wasn't done, and it wasn't done because a judge was obsessed with clearing his docket.
Yeah.
That means you're not getting due process. That means you're not getting a fair shake.
Yeah.
And we need to lower the criminal docket so that federal judges can do justice on the civil side as well as the criminal side.
Well, that ties into so many other things that are important to progressives right now, like Black Lives Matter and judicial, the reform of the judiciary in terms of how we're jailing people and all of that. I mean, it ties into about 50 other things that are important to us. So it's all of a piece, folks.
Right. And if you'll indulge me, I just want to talk a little bit about what this, because it's one of the most frustrating aspects politically for me in these discussions about the Supreme Court. How many times have you heard a conservative decry the judicially activist Supreme Court in the last 30 years?
Oh.
That's all they ever said about it.
Right.
In the last 30 years, the most judicial activism you've ever seen has been by the Supreme Court on issues that are sacrosanct to businesses, on the antitrust laws.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you one example, and I can tell you that it personally affected a case I had that I'm still bitter over. The summary judgment standard in cases that aren't antitrust law and some of these other areas, securities law, has basically been, generally, you make all inferences in favor of the non-movement, in the most, generally that's the plaintiff, so that if a reasonable juror could say, you know what, yeah, there's conflicting testimony, but I believe the plaintiff's witnesses, then the plaintiff wins. The way the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions on a series of areas, in the antitrust area in particular, has developed the law, the standard is beyond that. You have to go further. You have to basically, they use a phrase called tend to exclude the possibility of monopolistic or violations of antitrust law. So tend to exclude means what? It doesn't mean more likely than not anymore. So they turned this into almost beyond a reasonable doubt standard in the civil court for an antitrust plaintiff.
So you have to prove what other people were thinking?
I have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, in essence. You can't have inferences. You can't, exactly. Well, you have to prove. It's interesting that you use that because conspiracy is obviously an important part of antitrust law. That is, a restraint of trade with two or more actors is the staple. of antitrust law. So proving that two people are acting together, well, they're not going to admit it under oath, right? They're going to lie, right? Not necessarily lie, but they're not going to admit it. How do I prove it? Well, I can't prove it by inference, by circumstantial evidence, by using common sense. I did a case, and it was argued before the First Circuit. I had an admission on the record of one or two players that basically, in my view, admitted that he had, in fact, reached an agreement with his co-conspirator. The First Circuit, bound by Supreme Court precedent, said, that's nice, but you needed more.
Wow.
And they basically admitted, said, listen, if this was a normal case, then of course I'd deny summary judgment. But this is an antitrust case, so I can't.
Hmm.
Literally, that was written into the opinion. I paraphrased it, but that's the way it went.
I
tell you, I'm still bitter about it.
I bet. My business belongs to a large trade organization, and we have a trade show every year. Very, very large trade show. And I want to say 10 or 12 years ago, our organization basically sent out an alert to everybody and got us all together as much as they possibly could in a meeting prior to the opening of the trade show that year and said, hey, folks, there's a real problem with antitrust, and we think the Justice Department is watching us in particular, and you know, we think that they might be moving against us, so be very, very careful about, because you're all in one building. It's very easy to talk to one another and not purposefully do something that would create a, you know, an environment of collusion, but to accidentally create an environment of collusion. And the they sent us repeated notices about it, and they did that for year after year until a couple of years ago when they got us all together again and they said, hey, you know what, it's not so bad now. The standard has been raised, the bar has been raised, so you're in pretty good shape, don't worry about it.
Yeah, pretty good shit. Yeah, but look, you may think that's good policy, what have you.
I mean,
let's say the other side thinks that's the right policy. But you know how we enact policy in theory? We pass laws.
Right.
Nobody has amended the Sherman Antitrust Act in terms of Congress. There's been no legislation. Well, there's been minor things, but the essence of it never changed in terms of its language of the statute. But it has been wholeheartedly, completely gutted. And it's been gutted by a judicially activist Supreme Court who changed the law. And nobody has said a word about this. And this has been going on in a terrible way for the last 30 years.
It's really frustrating to just kind of stumble across basically one article in one place and realize sort of through the back door that this is a huge, huge deal that nobody's talked about.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's been one of my frustrations that when we talk about the Supreme Court, you know, the Supreme Court's something that people pay attention to on occasion, more so now than before. But, you know, we focus just on Citizens United and
Women's right to choose.
Yeah. Women's right to choose, and these are hugely important issues.
Now,
I don't mean to belittle them. But the day-to-day of what the Supreme Court does to undermine the common citizen is flabbergasting, and it is a usurpation of our governing rights, how we rule ourselves. This is it's an undermining of democracy. In the most fundamental, basic way. And people don't get that. Every day that the Supreme Court issues a decision, generally speaking, the Roberts Court, they're undermining our democracy almost every time.
Just to ask one final question before we sign off of our extra mad portion. The Supreme Court has completely gutted our antitrust laws, is doing everything it can to take away our right to have our day in court, is making rulings that subvert our democracy in favor of the corporations, that remove our control over our own economy. We talked about how legislation can stop it, but why the hell aren't people paying attention to this? Why doesn't anybody know this is happening?
I mean, in some ways, I guess I got to blame myself and us. Are we not talking about it effectively? How do I talk about this? I've written much less about it, I have to admit. I haven't written nearly enough this year, but it's been a busy year. Mm-hmm. But in the past, I wrote a ton about this and other issues, and obviously I wasn't getting there. You know, whenever there's a Supreme Court vacancy, sometimes it resonates a little bit. But day to day, today, you know, it just doesn't get the headlines. And I'm not sure if I'm doing it wrong and those of us who write about the Supreme Court are doing it wrong. But clearly we're not doing it right. And it's something we have to think hard about. I wish I had an answer to your question. And when you get one, please let me know, because then I'll just infringe your copyright and just follow your model.
Well, folks, that's why we all need to get a little extra mad, I think.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah, I got a lot of mad in this segment, maybe too much. So, but thanks for letting me do so.
Yeah, Armando, thanks for being on. This has been Extra Mad. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.